8:16 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Utah legislature has concluded for the year. In the studio with a recap of how tourism came out, we invited Park City Chamber Bureau Director Bill Malone in to discuss the results of this year's session. Good morning to you, Bill.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what's your assessment?
Thankful they only meet once a year. let's say quite a few things this year that had tourism-related implications. First of all, you know, in terms of the good news, the Tourism Marketing Performance Fund, which how the state funds tourism marketing, and that did receive $21 million. It's the same as last year. So some could look at that and say, oh, gee, we didn't, you know, move forward on that. But the good news is that the 21 became kind of the permanent funding, the base level funding now. So from now on, it'll start at $21 million, the conversation in next year's budget. So that's pretty positive. It's important for a lot of pieces around the state. For us, you know, we are able to tap into some of that money through co-op plans with the state to do international marketing and do some of our campaigns, but also 10% of that money goes to the Utah Sports Commission. And that funds helps to fund a lot of events up here in terms of the World Cup at Deer Valley, you know, the activities, many of the competitions at the UOP, and also is kind of a big partner for the World Championships, the freestyles and free skiing and snowboarding World Championships in 2019 that will be occurring here. So it's important that that money was there. Let's see, a couple of there was one that was kind of interesting was there was a state lodging tax that was passed at it's a very small amount, 0.3%. It's only geared to generate this year, I believe, around $3.5 to $4 million statewide. But the interesting part of that is that the state has never been in the lodging tax business. This has always been a local tax levy by counties and municipalities around the state. And so those dollars are dedicated to outdoor recreation. And it's a grant program that the state operates. Operated last year, there was $1 million in the account last year out of the governor's budget. And this year, there'll be about close, like I said, maybe $4 million moving forward in that.
Is this an additional tax to the lodge, or does that come out of
something? No, it's an additional tax. It'll be a new line item on the tax bill for state lodging tax. The part of this that is most concerning is the creep of this in terms of where does this go now that there is a tax line on there. Does it go move up in numbers, or does it start to find other purposes as to that they want to tack on in that area? So that's been some concern on that.
Now, is this the money that they're waving at outdoor retailers? I mean, we had heard earlier this session, it was like, oh, we've got $1 million to bring you back.
Yeah, I don't think that's the same pot of money. This one is really dedicated towards trails, the ability, I think they see a growing population in the state and some type of source of revenue that can help get people connected to the outdoors.
Yeah. Back to the marketing fund. I mean, are you seeing any pushback, though? I mean, given the traffic jams that we have seen this year, we've already heard about the event kind of pushback. Mm-hmm. So does this now impact you?
In terms of the state?
Well,
on this,
no, just, I mean, just in local.
General?
Yeah, just locally here.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, we obviously have our ears to the ground and looking at it. However, we have a mission to do. I mean, our that's the purpose of the Destination Marketing Organization is to look at that. And obviously, we're looking at times of the year, trying to impact times of the year, trying to balance out, trying to create a strong economy for people in a number of ways in terms of people to be able to be employed for a longer period of time in the community. So, yeah, I mean, we're not immune to hearing the cocktail conversation, but generally I don't think it changes the way we are doing business.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, though, you know, some 30 years ago, the Chamber Bureau directors back then said Sundance, yeah, come to Utah in mid-January because there was nothing going on. And now right. We already hear business people saying, no, we're busy in January.
Yeah.
So
It changes, as time goes on. In terms of that, in terms of times of the year, I mean, when you can certainly look at the town at certain times of the year and say it's to max capacity. When you look at it overall in terms of the times of the year, we're probably closer to about a 48% occupancy rate in our community. So there are the ups and downs of that.
Yeah, but I'm not sure anybody could tolerate 100% occupancy.
No,
all the time.
We've never seen 100% occupancy either.
What's going on this week? Main Street was packed.
It's just a big week. This week, and then it starts to fall off pretty steeply after this week. But it's kind of funny when you look at the calendar; it kind of shifted. This next week was actually the big week last year because it was last year. Easter was on the 27th of March, and so this preceding week to Easter was pretty big. So it kind of shifted back. This been one of those years where you try to look at the spring break calendars around the country, and they're kind of all over the place because Easter really comes so late in the game in terms of an Easter on April 16th. It kind of throws spring breaks all over the place from early March to Easter. The fact that next year Easter's on April 8th, I believe. No, April 1st. It is. So it'll probably be at an optimum time in terms of the spring break time. But yeah, this is a big week for us this week.
Yeah. Well, you've no doubt have seen or heard about the two full page ads from the National Beverage Institute condemning Utah for its decision to drop the DUI threshold down to 0.05%. So this is a really tricky situation here. I mean, we all agree that we don't want drunk drivers, but does this take it too far?
I just don't like us being the first. You know, it'd be one of those things that maybe if this was something that we were following instead of leading on, because we become such a target for these things, and we have to put the public relations work together on all of these issues. It seems like, you know, whether it's backlash on outdoor retailer, whether it's a couple of years ago with Prop 8, and you know, we're always fighting that uphill battle in terms of trying to deal with perception. The issue with this one is that for us is we're just dealing with it from a public relations side at this point in time. Anxious to see what comes about, whether the governor can be influenced in terms of vetoing this. It was a close vote in the Senate. I've been talking to Senator Van Tassel about it. He voted against it. But at the end, I think the argument of, you know, better safe than sorry in terms of the 0.05 prevailed. Whether this is going to be as impactful as some people talk about, I'm not sure. I think from a Park City perspective, you know, our spin on this is we're encouraging you to use public transportation anyway. You know, we're trying to get people out of renting cars and in their vacation here and using public transit, using our 17 transportation companies, using the vans and buses that our hotels provide the guests, the propensity of Lyft and Uber in our community. There's no reason why you still can't come here, party to your heart's content, and get home safely back to your room. So we're kind of spinning it and talking about if there is impacts, we're probably one of the best places that you can be in terms of if you have to deal with this. Is it a black eye in terms of just from a PR standpoint? Yeah, it's another challenge for us to work on. But we don't believe it's the end of visitation, too, as some people may portray.
Also, NPR reporting this week that European tourists refusing to visit the U.S. because of President Trump. Have you or do you expect to see any anti-Trump effect here in Park City?
We're keeping an eye on that. We've heard some anecdotally. We've seen some things written about in terms of lift ticket sales to Mexico customers. I've been in a meeting this week with a lot of my counterparts from throughout the West, and we're talking about impacts to international visitation politically as to what's going on. And we kind of, it's interesting. One of the things that I'm hearing from people is that it is the guest. It's having an effect on the first time visitor to the U.S. The guest who has come here before is not so susceptible to being influenced in terms of this. And so that may be maybe a maturity in terms of their travel or their worldliness in terms of that they go around the world traveling. But there is definitely a concern. There is no data at this point to do it. We talked to reporters who have written the story but don't have any data to put behind it and looking for that data. But we haven't seen it. We're going to see where we stand in terms of our lift ticket sales at the end of the ski season to see if there has been any changes in international customers from our – we sell a two-resort international pass internationally to tour operators and international consumers. And so we're gonna total up. The initial part at the beginning of the season, we didn't see anything. Maybe this season was too early in the game, you know, to have an impact on that. But we're watching that closely.
And finally, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, has the Chamber Bureau at all been hit up to help fund the Bonanza Flat effort, given that open space is certainly one of the targets that you mm-hmm. use to market?
Yeah. No, we haven't.
Do you have money for something like that?
It's not in the budget. It's not in our – we're typically not making donations. It's not in our mission. But no, we haven't been asked.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Hey, Bill, thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, thank you, Leslie.
8:29, good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council yesterday unanimously approved the motion to authorize the sale and issuance of up to $25 million for the purchase of Bonanza Flat. In the studio with an update, I have Park City Council member Andy Bierman, and on the phone with us, the director of Utah Open Lands, Wendy Fisher. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So, Andy, you met with the Summit Land Conservancy Board yesterday, and I guess even with the disappointing news of Salt Lake County voting down financial participation on the Bonanza Flat purchase, you and Winnie both, I think, still extremely hopeful that this purchase goes through?
Yeah. It certainly was disappointing. We thought Salt Lake County was going to support this, and we thought there were many reasons they should. But it is a minor setback. But the reality is the first 90 days, we were able to raise pledges for about $9.5 million. And we think with another 90 days, we can close that gap of $3.5 more. And we spoke to our partners and talked as a council and talked to Wendy about going forward. And we all agreed that we have enough momentum that we should proceed with this.
So, Wendy, give us a recap on where we are in meeting that $13 million goal. I mean, how much money do we need?
Well, we need $3.5 million still. We know that we have support from Salt Lake Public Utilities. We're waiting for them to make their announcement. We know that we have just over $2 million from other pledges, challenge grants, and the 11-member nonprofit coalition. And then, of course, you know, we can't forget Summit County that really kicked it off with their $5.75 million.
So, Andy, why then pass the bond consideration at last night's meeting? I mean, if we were going to do it, maybe we should have done it a week ago before interest rates went up 0.25%.
I'm not sure how big of an impact that's going to have on us just because of we have such a high bond rating. We have a AA++, I think, which is outstanding. So we get incredible rates. But it's just a matter of we're trying to – this. It's complicated timing. And we needed to wait as long as possible to see whether we had enough momentum before we entered into the bond process because it's a lot of work and some expense to do that. But now we've initiated that. If for some reason we wanted to back out, I think we have till May 23rd, though, that we could cancel that bond.
All right. And the cost associated with this, we'd heard anywhere between $50,000 and $150,000. That's quite a difference.
Yeah.
Do we know?
We're just not sure.
Hmm. So what happens next? I mean, we're waiting for Salt Lake City Public Utilities to make a decision, what, Tuesday?
Wendy, you want to take that?
Yeah. I mean, they've told us that basically they're hoping to make an announcement of what they're contributing on Tuesday. But that is already counted in the total that we have. So we still have that $3.5 million to raise. And I think, you know, there was almost 3 hours of testimony at the Salt Lake County Council meeting. And I wouldn't be surprised if we aren't going back there at some point to ask them to help close that gap as well. But we're already looking to new sources. I'm already working on moving forward with a couple of other new grant sources that hopefully will come through. We are just not going to stop. This is too important.
Yeah. So how much can we expect Salt Lake City Public Utilities to contribute? I mean, when they talked about buying open space prior, they told us they spent about $300,000.
Well, actually, the $300,000 was from Salt Lake County. Salt Lake Public Utilities actually has a tax on top of their, basically they call it their enterprise fund. That's specifically for protecting watersheds. So we know that they have the ability to do a substantial contribution. And if you do the numbers, you know, obviously we're counting on something in the range there, getting us closer to the $2 million that's part of that $9.5 million gap.
Well, Council Members Becca Gerber and Nan Worrell mentioned they had met with the Girl Scouts talking about cookies and leadership programs. What did any open space discussion occur with them, given that they do have a vested interest in keeping Bonanza Flat free of development? Andy, do you know anything?
The Girl Scouts have been part of the discussion, and I know there was a very large anonymous donation made on behalf of the Girl Scouts at the Montage fundraiser. I believe it was $200,000. So
yeah, and actually, that was the Janet Q. Lawson Foundation that made that contribution to help match the challenge grant. Andy's right.
Okay, so they have contributed to the cause.
They have. They've been good partners in this.
And then I just mentioned to Bill Malone whether or not he'd been approached, given that certainly open space and trails and things like that is something that the chamber markets all the time. He said he hadn't been hit up yet.
I think we're going to expand our circle at this point. We really were focused on our large institutional partners to begin with, the ones that could make a big dent in this. And now we're down to probably our second level of folks we're going to talk to, and that's going to be a much bigger circle. And I do want to just throw something in because I've heard a lot of anger towards Salt Lake County that they didn't participate in this. And I will agree that we are all disappointed. But I do want to point out there were hundreds of people that emailed or showed up and testified from Salt Lake County that wanted them to participate. And I believe Wendy told me that the day after this, she got 350 donations where people were disappointed with their council, so they wanted to personally help. So I think we need to be careful not to make broad accusations that they aren't participating. It was largely a political decision. It was made strictly upon Republican and Democratic lines, losing by just one vote.
Okay. Let's move on to Sundance. Wendy, I can drop you now.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Wendy.
Thanks, Wendy.
And the council seemed to be in agreement with that Sundance Film Festival is good for Park City and people want Sundance to remain, but we've got problems with the increasing presence of sponsors and those not Sundance sponsors. And one example I think that was thrown out was the Acura Street venue. Some merchants thought it helped their business. Others said no. So how do you move forward with input like that?
Yeah. Well, I think we need to look at this Sundance as somewhat unique in terms of we had the storm of the decade happen during the busiest part of the festival, and we had 9,000 extra people show up for the Women's March. So we can't judge it strictly off of that. But the challenges we had with traffic and having enough public spaces to host it and dealing with the non-affiliated marketers, those are ongoing challenges we've had with Sundance. So that's what the conversation focused on with council. And I think the things we committed to do to move forward, we're going to meet with Sundance and the downtown merchants and maybe some of the major property owners and start working on whether we can add some stability over time in terms of making sure that Sundance and their sponsors have appropriate spaces. And then we also talked about what I will call aggressive traffic measures, perhaps something more like some sort of hybrid between what we did at the Olympics and Arts Festival, where we really try to keep all commercial traffic off our residential streets. Maybe we create a centralized area for taxis and shuttles and then have some sort of circulator and really try to manage the vehicles better, because we think that's what's overwhelming the festival more than anything.
Yeah. Alfred Knotts talked a little bit about the dedicated bus and high occupancy vehicle lanes used in town during the festivals. So we just saw this on Deer Valley Drive. Was that it? Do we need to expand those?
I think our plan long term is to expand those, period. You're going to see those on 224 and 248 in a couple of years. So we're going to continue to experiment with that. I think we had a few breakdowns because of the weather. We had cars stall in the bus lanes and problems like that. So we're going to continue to refine it, but that's more of what we're we're going to see.
Yeah, and then I think you also talked about doing some kind of circulation study, just whether or not there's just maybe maybe we just do one big loop and everybody going in the same direction?
Yeah, we know we have a problem and it's not going to get better. So you're going to see us experiment with some things, and I hope we have patience from the community as we try these. But the whole goal is to make for a better festival and also not to totally impinge upon our residents of Old Town who got pretty beat up this year with all the traffic on residential streets.
Yeah. Property rentals, the city's working to kind of clamp down on the party house rental situation. Is it working?
I think it's made an improvement. When we decided that we wanted to push the traffic into the downtown, it got it out of the residential area. But if we were to clamp down harder in town, we squeeze the balloon and push it back out in the residential area. So that's the balance we're trying to reach.
All right. So in terms of working with merchants then, that you're going to try and identify those locations earlier so that they're surprises?
Last year, we had a conversation with Sundance, including a number of folks from their L.A. board, and they came in and they said, can we work on a long-term plan? Maybe we secure some spaces for long-term for our sponsors so we know that's in place. We don't have to do any last-minute audibles like they did on Lower Main, and maybe that's a way that they can manage the affiliated marketers. If they take the spaces, then there's going to be no pressure to rent those to other parties. And I just ask that we continue that conversation, and maybe the city can ask as a facilitator. It always gets dangerous if we overly meddle in the free market, but we can certainly sit down with all the parties and separate the fact from fiction in terms of what the rents are, what spaces are really available, and see if we can't come up with a better situation.
All right. The library field preservation before you, a unanimous motion, I believe, to move ahead with some sort of preservation of the field, but you didn't decide what that looks like?
Well, we know it's going to be a third-party easement. There's been a little bit of concern because this is such an unusual use for a traditional conservation easement. We don't want to devalue those because there is going to be a lot of exceptions for temporary events and potential other uses. So it was really a nomenclature discussion. I think we're going to call it a park easement or something along those lines. What council agreed to is they said, yes, they want a third-party easement that will protect that field forever, make sure that there are no habitable structures built on that. And so the next step is we're going to sit down, we're going to find who's going to handle that third-party easement for us, put them together with the COSAC and BOSAC recommendations, and see what the management plan looks like.
So does this happen then to all other neighborhood parks as well?
That is not the recommendation from RAB. We asked that question whether they wanted to come up with a whole new urban park designation or something, and RAB said that they thought the library park was unique enough that it should be addressed by itself, and they didn't want to have that broader conversation. They do not feel like we need a third-party easement on other parks.
All right. And real quick, wanted to ask you, this was continued until the April 13th meeting, but the amendments to the land management code were trying to limit the length of a street front to 50 feet. Why are we doing this? I mean, there's some talk about it would prevent chain stores from coming in. Or is that the intent?
Yeah,
of this?
I think we enjoy the sort of rhythm of the street having lots of small businesses on the street, and we don't think it would be beneficial to turn it into more of an outdoor mall kind of feel. And council's been working on this with the downtown merchants. Jonathan Weidenhammer's put a ton of time into it for almost a decade. And so this was a code proposal that would limit storefronts to 50 feet, hopefully preserving our character on the street. However, we were concerned that it could have some unintended consequences with one of our merchants, which is Grappa, who's looking at doing an expansion. And that's a very unique triangular lot that the kind of a trapezoid, actually, that they're looking at doing an expansion on the frontage, which could be over 50 feet. We're not sure that would be impacted because a lot of theirs is on second story. But rather than pass something that we would then maybe hurt one of the businesses that's an anchor to our street, we continued it until April 13th so that we would have some time to talk to them before we pass it.
All right. Anything else you want to mention?
Just two quick things. First, I wanted to thank all the citizens that came out last night in support of the library field. They've been very active throughout the process, showing up to COSAC and RAB meetings and giving us feedback. So big thanks for them to showing up. And then I wanted to mention that we have another Opry with Council coming up on Tuesday, the 28th at 4 to 5:30 at the Spur. And if you haven't gone to one of those, I'd really encourage you to. I Cindy and I hosted the last one. It was great. It was kind of a smallish group, only 20 people, but every single person in the room got the opportunity to ask at least one question. I thought it was a great discussion.
All right. Andy, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Park City Council Member Andy Bierman. Well, the students at South Summit High School this week kicked are celebrated Kick Butts Day. It's a day to proclaim their independence of big tobacco. Here in the morning, this morning, to talk about the new threat and misconception of nicotine devices like vaping, I have Alyssa Mitchell. She's a health educator with Summit County Health Department. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So first, when we think about tobacco, we think about cigarettes, and now that's kind of dropped off in the last several years. What are the new ways that big tobacco, though, targeting American teens?
So big tobacco is coming out with these new products. They're called electronic cigarettes. There's lots of different names for them, actually. Youth tend to refer to them as vapes, PVs, mods, terms like that. So basically what they're doing, instead of having a tobacco leaf that they burn, like in regular tobacco products, or chew, they've turned the nicotine into a liquid and put other liquid chemicals into these electronic cigarette devices. The liquid is heated and creates a similar sensation to that of smoking, that vapor.
So vaping and e-cigarettes are the same thing?
Yes, they are the same thing. There's just a lot of different names for it.
Yeah. So is it any different, though, than smoking a cigarette?
Well, the same amount of the same types of chemicals are found in both cigarettes and electronic cigarettes, the juice. So we'll still find nicotine in both products. We'll still find chemicals like formaldehyde and benzene and all these other really harmful cancer-causing chemicals in both products. So really the only difference is one's a liquid and the traditional tobacco is based off of the leaf.
Yeah, so we're also then seeing effects, secondhand vape effects then, both not only in people but pets, I'm hearing.
Yes, so, and even with regular tobacco products, our pets, when we, you know, as you smoke, the secondhand vapor, the secondhand smoke that goes out, not only do people breathe that in, but pets do as well. And it's been shown in both pets and humans to cause adverse effects. So you can actually still get lung cancer from secondhand smoke. And pets have been seeing cancer in their snouts. So like dogs will get it in their noses as well, and they'll have breathing problems as well. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah, and even just as innocent as, you know, cats, dogs tend to clean themselves, and so they're just almost licking it off their fur.
Yes, it does get stuck to their fur, just like it gets stuck to a smoker's clothes as well.
So people, if they think they're being safer by taking, you know, not smoking but vaping, they're really kind of
no, they're exposing themselves to the same kind of chemicals. It really just looks different. Now, the long-term effects of e-cigarettes we are still studying, but what I'd like to point out is that even though it took a couple of years to figure out that regular tobacco products were harming our health, it's likely that we're going to see the same thing with electronic cigarettes and vape juice.
All right. So, again, we had this event, Kick Butts Day, in South Summit. I mean, what were you seeing some trends there in South Summit with teens and tobacco use?
We're actually seeing trends in Summit County high schools in general. So not even just at South Summit. Our other schools are noticing an increase in youth experimentation with these electronic cigarettes and even regular tobacco products. Our regular youth e-cigarette rate here in Summit County is 9%. For kids in grades 8 and up. And actually, experimentation is higher than that. It's actually 20%. So because of the common misconception that e-cigarettes are safer, there's a lot of experimentation in use with it. So that's why we're trying to use days like Kick Butts to educate kids about regular tobacco products, but these electronic cigarettes as well.
Okay, so does this Kick Butts Day come to Park City High School and North Summit High School as well?
We're looking to try and partner with them in the future. This year it was just South Summit. Oh. But with Park City High School and with North Summit, I have gone in and done electronic cigarette education in their health classes. I'll go in and talk to the kids and do special presentations on the harmful effects of electronic cigarettes. I've even got a little display to show them what some of these things look like so that they can at least recognize what other people are using and be knowledgeable about it.
Okay. And this funding is coming from the anti-tobacco campaign that we saw some kind of settlement for, huh?
Yes. So years ago, like in the 1990s, there was the big tobacco settlement. And from that tobacco settlement, there was money set aside for education to go talk with students, to talk with even general populations about the harmful effects of tobacco products.
Okay. People want more. You have it on the website?
We do. SummitCountyHealth.org.
Okay.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Alyssa, hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:48. Good morning. Well, the Park City School District hosting its next Lunch and Learn on Tuesday, March 21st at the school district office. In the studio to discuss the topic, I have Dr. Kathy Einhorn, the Technology Learning and Teaching Associate Superintendent. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So the topic is assessment analysis, or in other words, why the heck do we test our kids so much? So why do we?
Absolutely. And that's the topic of our Lunch and Learn next Wednesday.
Oh, it's Wednesday. Okay.
Or Tuesday. Tuesday. What we really have decided is there are lots of misperceptions about assessment. And so we said, why don't we give parents a chance to hear about the top three assessments we give, which are SAGE and Galileo and DIBELS. Of course, if they have questions about others, we can answer those too. But really focus on why are we giving that particular assessment, what are we measuring, and how are we using the results of the assessment.
So there's more than those three?
There are more than those three, but they're pretty much specific to groups of kids. So, for example, we give the APL assessment, which is the language assessment, to students who are in the DLI program, third grade on up. There are AP assessments, of course, given on a broad scale here. SAT is given. So we can address other questions, but we really wanted to explain why these three are given.
All right. So are these required tests from the state of Utah?
The SAGE is required and the DIBELS is required from the state of Utah. Galileo is our assessment, which is our benchmarking. And that's one thing we want to talk to parents about is what each measures. So why are we giving these three assessments? SAGE really is a measure of what students do over the course of the year and based on the standards. SAGE is really used as part of the grades for our schools. And so last year in particular, our scores came down. Our high school had a grade of C by the state. And that was largely because of lack of students taking SAGE. But we do use those SAGE results to see how do we stack up compared to other schools across the state.
So why do we allow our students then to opt out of them if we're, they're supposed to be taking them?
Great question. There is a state law that allows that to happen, which is kind of ironic because they're required by the state, but parents can opt out. The problem with opting out is that then we lose the data for those students. And we do rely on Galileo, which is one measure. It's nice to look at more than one measure because, you know, I know on any particular day, a student may not be feeling so well. They may have had a bad evening and come in and take a test. And that particular measure might really be indicative, not be indicative of what they can do. So if we have more than one data point, which really we try to look at least three for kids, we have better information about what that student knows and can do.
So is there an opportunity then to reduce some of this testing?
There's a lot of talk about that across the country. Assessment is a big hot topic across the country. And I know that across the country, legislators have been discussing this. We're discussing how we're using the assessments we're using, and what could we replace as we move forward. But I think that right now, based on how teachers are using the data in PLCs particularly, along with what they see in the classroom, it gives us a good basis to know, oh, my students really don't understand this standard, so I need to do some more instruction here.
Okay. Again, if people would like to learn more, you'll be at the Park City School District office Tuesday starting at noon. That's March 21st. And people come with questions.
Absolutely. Come with questions and your lunch.
Okay. Kathy, thanks for your time. Well, Madame Christine Argelet is in Park City to support an exhibition of her extraordinary collection of Salvador Dali. She joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what brings you, I mean, you've brought the collection to Park City for Old Town Gallery?
Yes, for the first time in Utah. And this is a collection that goes from 1934 to 1973 with original copper etchings, drawings, watercolors, We also have a few tapestries hand-woven in Aubusson in the center of France in 1972-73. So it's a collection that is known, but not as much as, I would say, the old paintings of Dali. It's interesting because it's very spontaneous and very rapid annotations. It reveals a Dali that we don't always know, who is very joyful, very humorous. And it's mostly the 60s, which is a great time for Dali, where he is at the peak of his art, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did the Old Town Gallery get this? I mean, what's your connection with Old Town Gallery?
I think it's my... my agent here in the U.S. who told me that there was this possibility. But I requested many years from now, long ago. I said, well, I would love to go in Park City or in Aspen. And my father, who was Dali's publisher, was telling me, you have to go in places where you are not expected. It's much more interesting. And for me, it's beautiful to show this collection for the first time somewhere. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. So it was your father's collection that you...
Yeah, my father was Dali's friend and publisher for 40 years. And my father had really a passion for Dali's work. He was working with other artists of the Dada or Surrealist movement, but working with Dali was something exceptional. There was an incredible inspiration, a vibe. There was a lot of fantasy, a lot of freedom. You know, it was the happening time of all things that Dali could do. My father was a fan, and Dali would often say, well, Angèle is more Dalinian than myself, which was a bit true sometimes.
Yeah. So now you have lots of personal memories of Dali yourself?
I do, because we would go to a hotel which was just in front of Dali's house from mostly from 1960 to 1973-74. And the reason was that if my father was not next to Dali and gets his illustrations for the various themes he had commissioned Dali, Dali would sell the art and wouldn't think any bad. So my father had to be there, and that was the way he had found that, and we would spend the entire summers there. So it was a very interesting moment where you would see scientists, you would see Elvis Presley, and the next day you would see John Lennon, and then you would see Dali working from very early morning to the late afternoon in his studio on very large-scale paintings. So it was very interesting.
Yeah, so how many pieces are in the exhibit?
We have selected 83 pieces. We even have a set of porcelain plates that Dali designed for his museum and my father's museum near Paris. And we have three Aubusson tapestries that are extremely rare now, some drawings, and a collection of those works of the 60s, which are original copper prints, in the same way, done in the same way than Durer or Rembrandt or Picasso would do on a copper plate.
So are they just on exhibit, or is there an opportunity to purchase any of these?
This is an opportunity to purchase. When my father passed away in 2001, I was thinking, what can I do for this collection? And I was thinking the best would be that it shows up in museums and at big collectors' houses. And we have donated about 80 works at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art to different museums in France. And we have done those exhibitions in good galleries, and I'm so happy for that because it's a collection which is shared, and it's no more involved. So it's for me, it's alive, and it's beautiful.
All right, and it'll be on display here in Old Town Gallery till when?
So today, and I'll present the collection between 7 and 9 p.m. today, Friday. Tomorrow, it's open every day until Sunday, but I'll be there between 11 and 1. Also between 7 and 9 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday between 1 and 3 p.m.
Okay, and then it goes somewhere else.
Exactly.
Yeah, you've taken this worldwide, though, huh?
Very much so. Singapore recently, different cities all over the world, and trying to find unexpected places. And I feel happy.
Okay. Well, thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Christine Argelet in Park City again to show off the exhibition of her extraordinary collection of Salvador Dali.